is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150-plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
More than anything, you have to be yourself. You can fake it. You can fake being like what Coach K does you see on Twitter. You can fake being what Shaka Smart does, or you can fake being what Coach Calipari does, or anybody else. You go down to Popovich. You can try to emulate those guys as much as you want and learn from those guys and grow and read about them and do different things. And I've done all that stuff. However, the most important thing you can do is you can be yourself, because you can't fake that. And when times are tough, you're going to have to be yourself, and it's going to come out. And so you don't want to be two-faced. You don't want your guys to not trust in you and believe in you. You have to be who you are.
Chris Martin is entering his fourth season as the men's head basketball coach at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa. In 2019, Martin led the Duhawks to the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament for the first time in program history. Prior to his arrival at Loras, Martin was an assistant at Elmhurst College, his alma mater, for five seasons, where for the first time in Elmhurst history, the Blue Jays qualified for the NCAA tournament in back-to-back seasons. As a student athlete, Martin was an elite player for the Blue Jays, closing out his collegiate career as a two-time D3Hoops.com All-American. He was the first player in Elmhurst history to earn three CCIW All-Conference first-team honors. Martin finished his Blue Jay career with 1,736 points, a mark which ranks second in school history. After graduating from Elmhurst in 2005 with a bachelor's degree in business administration and management, Martin spent three seasons playing professional basketball in Luxembourg and Germany. After his final season as a player, Martin accepted the role as head coach of the Bayer Leverkusen Giants and guided his team to the playoffs in his only season. After you listen to our conversation with Chris Martin, jump over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a five-star rating and review. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe right now and visit our website at hoopheadspod.com to find every episode we've ever recorded. Let your friends and colleagues in the game know about the show so they can gain insights from some of the best minds in the game, from the grassroots to the NBA. You'll want to be ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Chris Martin, men's head basketball coach at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Chris Martin from Loras College. Chris, welcome.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're excited to have you on, get a chance to learn more about your basketball history, learn more about what you're doing with your program there at Loras. Want to start out by going back in time and talking to you about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid. So share a little bit of how you got into the game, what made you fall in love with it, and how it's become your life's passion.
Yeah, man, that's we could be here all night, I think. Yeah, so I don't know. I think I always grew up playing basketball and playing different sports and playing basketball, baseball, and football and different things. When I was younger, I had a brother that was 13 months older, and then I had another brother and sister that were, you know, 9 or 10 years older, and we were always into sports. And so whether it was basketball or something else, we were doing it outside together, messing around. And so I don't know. It wasn't any specific one day I woke up and I wanted to, you know, play basketball. It was just, that's what we did. We just play basketball, play sports, we compete. And I would say, you know, I was blessed to have a dad that had some flexible hours and some things, and everything I had until I got into school ball, whether it was baseball or basketball or football, until I got into school ball, my dad coached my brother and I. And that was, you know, at the time and even through college, that was super formidable. And I didn't realize it until now that I'm a little bit older and I'm coaching, and now I've got kids that are the age that I was being coached at. I didn't realize the impact that had on me. And so I would say that was big, just growing up, had my dad around. And you know, I grew up on a college campus, which was a little bit unique. And so my dad was a dean of students, so we had keys to the gym. And so my brother and I, and we would just, you know, it was 9 o'clock at night, and my dad would give us the key and we go shoot. And so having that ability and just, you know, being around it so much and being around a family that loves sports so much, just kind of helped guide me into basketball as I grew into middle school, high school, all the way up.
That's awesome that you had keys to the gym. There's nothing better. There's nothing better than that.
No, it was great. It was great.
Better than that. Go ahead.
There's never a boring moment. You know, it was never, I think nowadays kids get bored, they do different things. For us, you know, having a brother that was close enough and having the ability to do different things, being on a college campus, having keys to the gym, you were never bored. And so that was awesome.
Do you think being the youngest sibling in your family, getting beat up and kind of always having to chase your older brothers and sisters, do you think that had an impact on your development as a player?
Without question. You know, we see it now that I'm recruiting and I'm, you know, like I said, I've got a little bit more experience. You see it with, you know, as you recruit the youngest in a family, or now that I've got, you know, I've got three kids, my youngest is two, and he's just now starting to hold his own and pick on the 4-year-old and the 7-year-old. I definitely look back to when I was the youngest, and yes, I can remember like it was yesterday, all the beatings I took and all the competition stuff. And I can remember my brother being on my shoulders, you know, punching me in the shoulder, holding me down. I can remember all that. I can remember the summer, the year that I kind of got a little bit better on the same playing field as my brother, and he didn't take it so well. And so, I mean, he's way more competitive than I am. And, you know, I can just remember time and time again, not being able to leave the gym, even though I wanted to. And just, that was definitely a big part of who I am and how sports worked in my life and just how I see things. Yeah, definitely learned some stuff being on the bottom end of the totem pole.
So if you think back to your childhood here, and you mentioned that you played a whole bunch of different sports, and you think about how that sort of ties into the direction that youth sports has, the road that it's gone down today, where you have many more kids at ages 8, 9, 10 starting to specialize, and parents feeling that pressure to, you know, again, whether it's basketball or it's soccer or it's lacrosse or it's baseball or whatever sport it ends up being, parents feel that pressure to have their kids specialize. Can you talk a little bit about, one, your experience as a multi-sport athlete and how you feel it helped you? And then maybe just talk about the impact that it has on some of the student athletes that you've had a chance to coach during your coaching career, and how being a multi-sport athlete may have helped them to have success on the basketball floor.
Yeah, well, there's a couple different fronts on that. One, obviously, you know, I think everybody maybe seen this, saw this, heard the stat, you know, a couple years ago, Ohio State, you know, a high percentage, I want to say it was like 70% of their football players are multi-sport, you know, athletes. And so there's one side of it that is just, you know, the physical side where you are, you know, able to, you know, cut side to side better, be, you know, in basketball because you played soccer, and your hand-eye coordination is better for football, catching a football, because you played baseball. And so there's definitely a physical side of it that, you know, can help playing one sport. There's no doubt about that. There's no fighting that. You definitely learn some different things. And we tell our guys all the time, now that we're coaching them, like, do other things. And now that I'm a father, you know, having kids that are interested in certain things, I'll sign them up for everything in the summer just to try different things. And for me, the biggest thing I felt personally playing multiple sports was I was never stale. I was never, you know, dreading anything I was doing. I was never dreading basketball. And then, you know, when basketball was done, I was straight to baseball, and I was never dreading baseball. And when baseball is done, you know, you go to some basketball camps in the summer, and then football starting up. And so you're never really like just complacent. You're always just doing something, and you're with a different group of people, and you're working on a different thing that you love, and in a different competition. And so for us, you know, growing up, you know, like I said, my brother and I playing a bunch of different stuff, it was just fresh, and it kept our love for it. You know, I think now with youth, there's two different things. One is, you know, they don't get rejuvenated. You know, you go straight from your high school team to your AAU team, back to your high school team, back to your AAU team. Then you start the season, and you're just going round and round, and there's no time to catch your breath and change and value something different and still, you know, become a better athlete and a better person and a better, you know, friend. But it's all around basketball, you know, or it's all around football, or it's all around baseball. And I think sometimes when you do a bunch of different things and you compete in a bunch of different things, it gives you some perspective. And like I said, then you're just excited for the next thing. And, you know, my biggest argument, or the biggest negative, I feel like it with the specialization is just, you know, the ability and the willingness and the accepting of losing. You know, when you play one sport and you're going to play 60 games, yeah, you're going to lose 10 or 15 or 20 or 40. And like, yeah, it's okay, on to the next one. Where if you're only playing with your team for a little bit and you got, you know, one, two summer league tournaments. I think when I was in high school, we went to Dave Darnell's basketball camp, for crying out loud. And, you know, we played 9 games. That was the only thing we did all summer. So if we lost one of those, we were irked. We were upset. We were mad. You know, there was never a game that we played with our team that was kind of a throwaway game or a game that didn't mean so much. And now I think, you know, just like everything in life, when you do something and it becomes a habit, and accepting losing has become a habit for our youth and in different sports. And that's the biggest negative to me, not necessarily the specialization, because some people just like basketball, you know, and aren't, you know, big enough to be an offensive lineman, or, you know, don't like the slowness of baseball. So I get that to some degree, but just the complacency and the willingness and of losing is just that hurts. I think that hurts our youth.
Yeah, I think that is a huge difference from the era. And I'm a little bit older than you, but I agree with you 100% there, that if I think back to when I was in high school, yeah, maybe we went to a team camp, maybe we played in a summer league, mm-hmm. but I played 20 regular season high school games. Yep. And those games meant everything to me. And, yep. you know, the ones that I lost, you know, I still probably remember every single one of them. And I remember, you know, going home and being, you know, hard to console after not having, you know, not having won. And I have a picture of me, actually, I think it's probably from a summer AAU tournament, that my dad and I were the GMs, and we put together a team of, you know, at that time there was, you know, it wasn't the same way it is today. There was very few kids that were playing. So it was only the kind of the best of the best that were playing. But I have a picture of myself sitting against the bleachers in tears in a summer league game, you know, at this tournament after the game. And again, not that that's necessarily healthy to be, you know, upset and, you know, in tears after games, but to your point, it meant something to me because
right. it's healthy to care.
Yeah, exactly. There were just fewer opportunities for me to get a chance to go out and compete. Whereas, like you said, today, you know, like my son or my daughter's teams that I've coached, you know, their AAU stuff, and we'll go to a tournament and, you know, you got a game at 12 o'clock and you got another game at 3 o'clock and the 12 o'clock game ends and win or lose, you know, the first question after you break the huddle at the end of the, at the end of that game is, hey, where are we going to lunch?
Exactly.
And, you know, and that's more what they end up worrying about because, you know, there's always another game coming, like you said. I think that's definitely something that is very different. And the other point that I like that you brought up, which I think is critical, is that, you know, you mentioned that kids don't get stale, you know, or they never get a chance to, you know, that you nothing was ever stale for you. You were always on to the next thing and you were always looking forward to the next basketball season or next baseball season, next football season. And I think that that's something that kids who play one sport year round, they never get that absence that makes the heart grow fonder for that sport where you walk away from it. And maybe I'm shooting on in my driveway or I'm doing a little bit of something with basketball for 3 months during the football season. But man, by the time basketball practice rolls around, I'm ready to go. I can't wait to get back out on the court. Whereas like you said, if a kid's been playing AAU basketball for, you know, since they were 8 years old and now they're 14, they've basically had six straight years of nonstop, nothing but basketball. And so how do you get a kid to look forward to something when it's just day after day of the same thing? And I think that's definitely something that is a challenge that we face today. When you think about your players that you have in your program or players that you see out on, you know, when you're going out recruiting, how do you think that that competitiveness that you described that maybe was more prevalent in the past, how do you try to instill that in your current players and your team to sort of replace what they may have gotten naturally back 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah. And I mean, we're taking a couple steps ahead before we start talking about our program and what we do. And I will say that is a staple. If you ask some of our alumni and some of the guys that have played for us and guys on our team now, what is our culture about? And obviously we've got some pillars, we've got some different things, but I think the first thing hopefully our guys would say is everything's competitive. And that's because I just think that, you know, people go into the weight room and like, yeah, I'm gonna do a little weight and that's fine. Or people go play open gym and hey, that's fine. And people go to individual workouts and hey, this is fun. And it's, you know, you've been doing that for, you know, like you said, if you've been doing it since you're 8 years old playing AAU, the only way that you can maintain that from 8 to 18 is not necessarily the coast is the wrong word, but to be one speed, you know, it's hard and it's almost impossible for people to go, you know, balls to the wall, all in, lit on fire for 10 years, just going every day, all day, every day, thinking about it. And now they just, I think, become accustomed of just going one pace. And yeah, I'm going to go, instead of going 100 miles an hour sometimes and 10 miles an hour, you know, a couple of days, they're just going 50 all the time. And you know as well as I do, when you're giving 50% or only going halfway, it's not good enough at the next level, at the college level, professional level, or even high school level at the highest levels. And so that's something that we really, really focus on in our program, is to create that. And I'll tell you, the people that have been really, the players have been really successful for us are the guys that get it and they love that. And they've had that from day one. Yes, we can help, you know, lead a horse to water and we can try to bring guys along and try to create that culture. And I think we've done a great job, but at the same time, some of it's got to be recruiting and some of it's got to be, you know, get those guys that have that fire and that have that competitive edge and hate losing, you know, when you're walking up the stairs, you know. And that's how my staff and I are. I mean, we're competitive. When I want to be your best interview you've ever done. And when I listen to all of these, if I'm not, I'm going to be hard on myself and I'm going to break it down because I'm being competitive, you know, and that's really important to us. It goes down the line to, you know, making the best hot dogs when we serve the team, when we have a team meal, or doing a pumpkin carving contest when we're, you know, doing that type of thing and having the best pumpkin. You better believe I want to beat everybody. And I think our guys have done a great job of accepting that from our coaching staff and our program. But like I said, you can tell in high school who those guys are, because everybody says they want to get better and play basketball, but you can tell in high school. And I'll tell you, not that we don't recruit the guys that don't, because at the end of the day, if you're a player, you're a player. But those guys that have that edge and that competitiveness and have found a way to compete every single day, those are the guys that end up being All-Americans and leaders and helping you win championships, not just a couple games here and there.
All right. So I know we're jumping ahead, like you said, but I want to dive into this. How do you identify those guys who have that competitive fire? What is it that you look for when they're out on the floor? What is it that you listen for when you're having conversations with them? How do you go about identifying who those guys are that are going to bring that competitive fire to your program when you recruit them?
Yeah, well, there's two sides. There's one in the seeing in high school and seeing when we're recruiting those players, and when you see those players, you can tell because in AAU games they care that they lose. You know, you're texting them, "Hey, how'd you do last night?" or "How'd you do last weekend?" Like, "Coach, man, we lost to a team that was bogus and we should have won. I didn't play very well and we missed a couple shots, but we're gonna get them next weekend." As opposed to a guy saying, "Hey, how'd you do last weekend? Hey, yeah, I scored a bunch of points. We were okay, but my last game I scored 25. And you know, it right then, you know, okay, this dude cares about winning. This dude cares about competing. This dude took a little ownership, and you can see it right there with their answer. Or you talk to him after the game, and I know recruiting is, you know, going out to high school games is always. Feel like I'm at a middle school dance, one of like five coaches waiting to talk to a guy and
right.
Like back in the day. And so you're sitting there and, you know, I've never offended when they lose, when we're standing there waiting to talk to a recruit. If he talks to me and he's all salty and the conversation's awful, I'm like, okay, this is awesome. This dude is, he didn't want to talk to me. It's better than wanting to talk to me, right? Like if he loses a big game, or a regional championship, and he comes out and he's happy to talk to me and happy to see me, there's some issues there, right? I mean, he should be a little bit irked. And so through the process, you can pick out those guys. And then, back to our conversation about, you know, specializing in one sport, I can't say that, it's a multi-sport guys or those guys that are more competitive or the, you know, just basketball guys. I don't know if there's a link to that. I know that there was for me. But I mean, you can tell it right away. And so through the recruiting process, like I said, doesn't mean we're not going to recruit a guy because he doesn't have that edge, because there's a bunch of different reasons why he might not have that. One, you know, maybe his high school coach wasn't a great coach, or maybe, you know, he's got some stuff going on, or maybe he's never been pushed, but he wants to be pushed, or, you know, you never really know what's going on. So you don't stop recruiting a guy for that, but you just know you're going to have to try to bring it out of him. And then once they get to our practices and once they get to our program, you know, it doesn't take too much, too many practices to figure out who's competing. You know, you're playing a 3-on-3 drill for 10 pushups, you know, which is nothing. I mean, and a guy's, you know, upset with himself and his teammates because they lost a 3-on-3 rebounding drill, as opposed to somebody that's, it's only 10 pushups, no big deal. You know, and when you, everybody's mad when they got to run 10 lines. But when you put a small price on it, or, hey, you got nothing, or, hey, you got, you know, one burpee or something small, the guys that are the competitors, the guys that are the grinders, the guys that really, really care are as mad about that one burpee or those 10 pushups as they are if they had to run 5 miles. Because at the end of the day, it's not about that punishment or about it's just about that loss. And you can see those guys in a minute. And, you know, as we talk, I, you know, in my mind, I've got those guys picked out and they're just clear as day in our program and the guys that we've had of who that is. And those are the guys that we win with.
That competitive nature is something that I know when I first started coaching, that was one of the things that I always had the most difficult time with. And it took me a long time to sort of come to terms with the fact that not everybody was going to be as competitive as I had been as a player. And initially coming out of the gate as a coach, I found that to be extremely frustrating. How can you not care about the result of the game, or how can you not care about your performance? Not that they completely didn't care, but just didn't care as much as I cared about it. Right. And that for a long time just didn't make sense to me. And eventually I came to terms with it. As you said, you know, there are kids who, for whatever different reasons, aren't as competitive as others. And you can still get the maximum out of those kids and push them and get them to where you hopefully need them to go. But it's definitely a challenge if you're a competitive person to work with a player who isn't as competitive as you'd like them to be. And I think what you're talking about in terms of your practice and the way you set things up, that everything is competitive, you're training them. And yeah, there's maybe a certain ceiling that one guy has a higher ceiling of competitiveness than the next one, but you can certainly augment it, make it better by giving kids the opportunity to practice being competitive, which is what I hear you saying.
Right. Yeah. And it's everything in life. I mean, we compete in the classroom. We got three dudes in the same class and they all have papers due tomorrow. And we're like, who's going to get the best grade in here? Let's go. And, or we, you know, like I said, we have get togethers at my house, pumpkin carving contest. Like, we're not just coming to eat, you know, hot dogs and hang out, you know, carve a couple pumpkins. No, we're going to judge them and see who's the best. And Christmas party, we're not going to just have everybody over and do a white elephant present or have a meal or whatever. We're going to do minute to win it party, and we're going to put in teams of five and let's see whose team can win. And so I think that it needs, just like anything, it needs to be a habit to compete. And, you know, I think that this generation doesn't have it as much. I think they can do it. I think that the guys want to do it for the most part. I think guys want to compete and they want to win, and that matters to them. I just don't think that it's become a habit for them. I don't think that, you know, through youth sports and through everybody's high schools and, it's became a habit for them. And I will tell you that those high school programs and those AAU programs that do things the right way, they tend to have players that, you know, quote unquote, get it. You know, some of these high schools that we've had a ton of success recruiting, we got one high school, we've got four or five of their players, and they win 25 games every year. And that coach just gets it out of them, you know, and they are competitive. And, you know, we've been to practices and watched them coach and teach, and those guys are, they care. And so, you know, I think that it can get there. I think that your team can compete and it become a habit and it can become a culture. But I think that it's an uphill battle for the most part these days. However, you know, like I said, if you can find those right guys, those right programs to recruit from, it makes their life a lot easier.
All right. So talk to me about the balance between when you're recruiting a kid, watching them with their high school team versus watching them in the summer with their AAU team. How much do you weigh one more heavily than the other? Are they sort of equal? Does it depend upon who their coach is for high school and AAU, what program they're with? Just talk to me about how you use both the high school program and the AAU program as a tool to evaluate potential recruits.
Yeah, I will say that this year it is flipped for us. So in my whole coaching career, around 10 years, I would say in the past, I would have said unequivocally, without question, high school team, I've enjoyed more. I've gotten better, more out of it. And I felt like I have been able to evaluate talent and create relationships better through their high schools. And I will tell you, this year, I feel like it's switched. And I don't know what the reason is. I don't know. We changed some of our recruiting tactics and come up with some of our strategies to go a little bit earlier with their AAU team instead of the first time going out with their high school teams. And so we kind of tweaked some of what we did. So it might be that. However, I will tell you, through the programs, you know, every year we go through a roster. I think, like a lot of coaches, I'm no different. We're no different here. You go through and say, hey, who's this team? Who's this kid play for? What high school did he play for? What AAU program did he play for? Where did you see him play? When is the first time? You know, you go kind of go through and figure out where you got these guys and where you get your most bang for your buck and spend your most time. And I will tell you, we've really just focused on some of these AAU programs that have been really good to us. And not to say that we go outside of them, but I can tell you, you know, 70% of our team might be from four or five AAU programs and, you know, from all different high schools. But if you're talking bang for your buck and going out and seeing, you know, seeing kids and creating relationships with coaches and people that run these AAU programs, like I said, if you're surrounding yourself with the guys that do things the right way, because not everybody does, you know, I feel like more high schools do things the right way, at least try. If you can surround yourself with the right AAU programs and you can find your niche and find the programs that you like the way that they're doing things, like I said, this year it's flipped and it's been really successful for us, I think.
So in your mind, what makes, when you say a successful or a good AAU program, in your mind as a college coach, what makes a good AAU program? So if you're giving advice to high school players and parents of what type of AAU club or program they should be looking to find, what should they be looking for?
Yeah, the first and foremost is, do they practice? I mean, I think, you know, that that's so, funny, right?
It is, right? It is, totally.
I mean,
it's
there's
true.
AAU programs, you know, around us that you just show up on tournaments. I'm not joking. They, my assistants have coached for different AAU programs and done stuff, and they had one practice in all of July. And they just showed up to four or five tournaments, and they play, and they don't have plays. They don't have defense. They don't have anything. They just go out there, and they hoop. And while that's fun, that doesn't necessarily, you know, that doesn't show. I don't know if that's run the right way. You know, the other thing is, are they at the right tournaments? Are they playing high level competition? Are, you know, is that AAU program going playing at events that are subpar and that are, you know, don't have a lot of college players, that have, you know, one team, you know, five teams that, you know, don't have any college players on the team, just kind of put together ragtag type of thing. And so are they playing in good events? And then, you know, the third one is, what kind of coaches they have? Do they just have guys that are, you know, out there that don't have any necessarily coaching experience, or do they have actual college coaches that are college assistants, or they have high school head high school coaches that are, you know, coaching on the side, or assistant high school coaches, not just moms and dads. Not to say the dads can't do a great job. I hope someday I'm a decent coach for my kids' AAU programs. But you know, is it across the board for the most part high level coaches? So you're getting, you know, experience. And then, you know, the last thing I would say about that is, are they hearing the right things from that program? You know, because every program, I think, like, you know, some private schools, and you get in different things, you know, they want their guys to go D1 and they want their guys to go D2. And I get that. And I value that, because money matters and I don't want to dance around that. However, the good AAU programs are talking about fit. You know, they're talking about, and they're realistic. Yes, you could walk on at a D1 and maybe play at some point, but that might be tougher. Hey, you can get a D2 offer maybe if you hold out. Or, hey, you've got a D2 offer. However, you know, mom and dad have the money, and look at these schools. This is only D2 offer you have. They haven't been over 500 for 4 years. You might want to look into these options. These are high-level D3 programs that you're going to go win and be successful early in your career. And so, you know, whatever they're telling them, and as opposed to, you know, hey, go walk on this D1. Or, hey, go, you know, you got a D2 offer, take it. Hey, you got an NAI offer, take it. You know, go take that, do this, do that. And so, and maybe it's just me aligning with what they should be saying. I guess that's biased. But I think that if the program that they're with in the AAU season is just in their corner and wants their best fit, not necessarily trying to help themselves, but help the student athlete, I think that's what's important. So, yeah. Like I said, it runs the gamut with AAU, as you know. But I think that's what I would be looking for if I was a high school parent.
Yeah, I think those are two really good pieces of advice. One, that you want to make sure that the program has your son, daughter's best interest at heart. That's key. And then two, I always like to tell parents that, to me, the key critical element is, who's the coach? And if you get a good coach, I think sometimes, even if you have one individual coach who's good in maybe an overall program that's not as good, but if you have a good coach, you can sometimes have a good experience, yep, maybe even with a program that's not as good. And conversely, you can be with a really good program and get the one bad coach in that organization and have an experience that's not very good. So those are the two things that I always try to get parents to see is, you know, what's in it for the AAU club? Are they in it for the right reasons? And then two, what's the, you know, what are you getting out of the coach? All right, let's jump back to your playing days and your recruitment. At what point during your high school career did you start thinking that you were going to have an opportunity to play beyond high school? What was kind of your thoughts, dreams, as you were junior high, early in high school? Just talk a little bit about your process of going through high school basketball, and then eventually ended up in college basketball playing for Elmhurst.
Yeah, so I was lucky to have awesome coaches in middle school and high school, and had some really successful years and winning games. When it came to fruition to play, or when I knew I was going to play college basketball, I will be honest with you, it wasn't until after my senior year baseball. So I played my senior year, I played football, basketball, baseball, And same thing as my junior year, and we had some great teams and some great players that I was around, guys playing in the bigs and guys playing professionally, also basketball or minor league baseball and in the NFL. And so we were surrounded by some awesome athletes through high school. And I'll tell you, I was considering football and considering baseball, and I wanted to play out my senior year of baseball, and we had a great season. And then it wasn't until June, I think, maybe even July, after my senior year, when I really said, okay, I'm going to play basketball, and here are the schools that I'm looking at, and here's what's important to me, and then, you know, and then picking Elmhurst. And so, so I was really kind of all over the board. When I thought I could play, I think I just always assumed I was going to play. I don't know. It was, once again, it was not a aha moment that I was going to do something in college or try to compete at something in college. It was just, what am I going to do and where am I going to go type of thing. Those were the conversations we had. And luckily I had, you know, an older brother that had kind of gone through the recruiting process and you know, did a bunch of visits, and I was able to tag along a little bit and learn and grow and do that type of thing my junior year. And so, it was summer my senior year, and after my senior year, and I found what was important to me and found the school that fit, and it worked out kind of in a roundabout way, and then went up to Elmhurst. And it was important for me in high school, and it's kind of the process of picking a school and going to college has really framed my recruitment and how I recruit student athletes today. And it really is, because when I went to school, so I ended up picking Elmhurst, and Coach Shear was awesome to me. He ended up hiring me for my first job, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, I go up to Elmhurst and pass up a full ride to Olivet Nazarene, which is a Christian school, and I want to go play for a Christian coach, Coach Shear. And I'm thinking D3 is just easy. Like, I just show up and be the best player, you know.
Right, right.
In my mind, that's what it was. You know, I'm an all-state player. This is going to be cake. Like, I'm just going to walk in and, you know, we went in, we had a really good recruiting class. I went to a place that won the league the year before, so I knew the coach knew what they were doing. You know, it was up in Chicagoland area, and so I wanted to get away from home a little bit. So it was a perfect fit. I go up there, and I was battling some injuries. However, I had a great freshman year. I was second team all league, and we finished second in a really good conference, and it was the worst year of my life. It was just a really tough year. I hated every second. My girlfriend at the time went to school, same place, played golf. Now she's my wife, so it worked out. And but it was a tough year. It was just different than what I expected. You know, I was going to practice for 2 hours, and I had, you know, training. I was going to the training room for 30 minutes because my back was bad, and I was lifting for 30 minutes. And then, you know, 2 days a week, we had scout for 30 minutes. So I'm spending 3.5-4 hours in the gym every day when my expectation was I was going to be there for about an hour and a half and dominate everybody and then go home. And you know as well as I do that's not the case.
Yep.
And so my freshman year, I went up there and had a good career, good season, and I hated it, and I left. I left Elmhurst, went to a junior college, didn't play, went back home, worked at a golf course, lifted weights, kind of, you know, got some perspective, and still kept a great relationship with the coach. I quit, quote unquote, quit the right way. It was after the season. I told him I just wasn't loving it. I didn't like it. He understood. It was a tough year, and as it is for a lot of freshmen. And so I took a year away, and I still, like I said, had a good relationship with him. I still saw him when I was going to visit my girlfriends and my wife. And after a year off, I'm like, okay, once again, you know, I'm not stale. I'm fired up. I want to play again. I go visit a couple schools, and I end up going back to Elmhurst for 3 years. I'm an All-American, have a good, you know, playing career. And the difference between the last 3 years there and the first year I was there is that we didn't practice any less. We didn't lift any less. I didn't go to the training room less. Actually, I got older, so I went more. We didn't do less scouting. The only difference was my expectations and what I was getting myself into. I knew what I was getting myself into. I knew what I was signing up for, and I was okay with it. I was excited about it, and I was all in for it. And that, like I said, that's really shifted my recruitment. I don't want any player to come play for me and my program and our coaches that they don't know what they're going to get. You know, when you get here, we're going to practice hard, and we're going to compete in everything we do. You know, we're going to play up tempo, and, you know, you're going to lift year round, and we're going to do X, Y, Z. And so we try our hardest to create as accurate of a picture of what our players are getting into before they get there, so that there's no surprises, so their expectations aren't thinking one thing and it's another thing. You know, we've lost recruits because, you know, they've asked us this summer saying, hey, where do I fit in with your program? I'm like, I don't know. I haven't seen my freshman. You know, right, I can't answer that question. And you know, give us till the middle of November when we've had a couple games on our belt. And now we have an idea of what we've got. So we can tell you if this point guard we brought in we think is really good, but maybe he stinks. And maybe we think there's a good role for you early in your career as opposed to waiting for a couple years. And so we've really tried to, and like I said, players don't like that because I think a lot of coaches say, you know, XYZ early on just to get a guy to be fired up about him. And so that has really changed how we recruit and has really been a big part of why we do things the way we do in the recruiting process, because I had such a, not a bad experience because it worked out. It was just, and it wasn't that I was misled by my coach or by the coaches at Elmhurst, because that wasn't the case. It was just, you know, I'm a small school kid and played a bunch of stuff and I was awesome in high school. And, you know, this is D3 basketball. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And so that's been really important to me. And like I said, changed some of the stuff we've done.
So two questions that come to mind off of what you just said. First one is, before you went to Elmhurst, how much D3 basketball had you watched as a high school kid?
One game. I watched one game, Illinois Wesleyan versus, like, I think the Claremont Mud Scripts or something, or Banana Slugs from thing. And I remember thinking in high school, I was a junior. My whole high school team went over. That was a junior. And we were 27-0, and we were ranked like top 10 in the state. We had some really good players on the team. I remember watching that game, being like, and I think Illinois Wesleyan was probably ranked in top 25. They were really good back in the day with Danny Bridges. And I remember watching that game, being like, man, these dudes are awful. What are you talking? We could beat them right now. Like, I mean, I could think, I remember talking
that's
to
hilarious.
My buddy saying, we could beat this team right now. And I'm like, looking back, I'm like, what an idiot. What was I thinking? This is a top 25 team in the country. They've got, you know, Corey Kuhn. They got, you know, Brian Crabtree, guys that have played opportunities to play in Europe. And I'm thinking to myself, we could beat these guys. I had no idea what was going on in reality and how high level and how hard teams had to play to win games and how, like I said, how good of those players were, whether they had offers before or whatever, and just chose to go to school because it's the right fit. And so that's the only D3 game I'd ever seen before I got into one as a freshman.
That's kind of amazing. I mean, I think I've heard that story, you know, similar from, you know, other D3 coaches that talking about recruits and saying, hey, you know, have you ever seen a D3 game? And them going, well, no, not really. And I think there's a lot of kids that have that same sort of mentality that you had, where they just don't understand. And I think parents same way, they don't understand how good you have to be to play college basketball at any level. I mean, forget about playing Division I, forget about whatever level it is. You know, if you're stepping foot on a college basketball floor, you're a darn good basketball player. There's no question about that. So another question that I wanted to ask you related to what you talked about there with your first experience was, you know, you talked about maybe it, you know, your expectations and how they changed the second time when you went back. So as you went into it, one of the things you mentioned was the amount of time that you had to put in that freshman year. What else besides the time, like what were some of those big adjustments that you had to make from your high school experience to that first freshman year at Elmhurst before you left? What was it exactly that didn't meet your expectations or was different than what you thought that made that year such a tough one for you?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One was the social side. You know, I was from a small town and, you know, I was thrown in with these grown men, 21, 22 years old, that are at different points in their lives and that are looking at jobs and they've got girlfriends that they're getting ready to get married to. And they're just at a different point than I am, where I just want to, you know, I'm there to play basketball and that's it. And so finding, you know, that our priorities aren't 100% aligned as a freshman to a senior was challenging. And so finding that core group of guys to hang out with and it's just, you know, some of the guys that were on that team that I ended up going back with, they were in my wedding as their wedding. I'm really close with them. And so, you know, it ends up being fine. But at the time, you know, finding that niche and being outgoing was tough. The other thing is, you know, I think hopefully through our conversation so far, you can tell I'm a pretty competitive guy. I'm pretty outgoing. We get after it and all of that stuff's important. In college, And so in high school, we didn't, you know, run a bunch of lines and we didn't play, we played a bunch of games. And if you lost, you were mad. I mean, I don't know how many times my brother and I are in practice as a junior, you know, coaches breaking up fights with me or, you know, we're pushing each other or different guys because you just wanted to win and the loser didn't have anything. You know, we were just doing it. In college, you know, there's a price to be paid for everything. And I didn't know that. You know, for me, I wanted to win that rebounding drill to win that rebounding drill. I could care less. But for, like I said, some of the guys on the team needed to be motivated with, you know, X, Y, Z. You're not going to play, you know, you're not going to start. You're going to have to run a bunch of lines. You're going to have to do this. And I didn't get, I always felt like we're punishing the group when a couple people are the guys you need to do something. And like I said, it was a very immature, young, stupid Chris Martin that didn't know, but I was just getting what I was getting myself into and the level of, you know, how we were creating a culture and how was the team, you know, above all else. I was just looking at it a very selfish, you know, intrinsic point of view and not necessarily from the outside looking in. And, you know, I couldn't get past, you know, I'm open for a shot and, you know, in my mind, it's a perfect shot. What are you talking about? If I got this in high school, I'd shoot it every time. But in college, it's one pass down the court, and the guy's kind of guarding me, kind of not. Well, now I know we're not going to get this offensive rebound. I know that now that I'm old. But at the time, I thought that was the best shot, you know, ever. And it was a struggle and an immature outlook in the sense, like, what are these coaches talking about? This is a perfect shot. This is as good as we're going to get. And so right. There was probably a bunch of small things that, you know, were just, like I said, that I didn't expect all of those things. I didn't expect how high level and how much film you're watching and how you had to go to the offensive glass every single time. And so that level of detailed, I just across the board, just didn't know what I was getting myself into. Didn't know about it. And that was just a struggle.
What's your favorite highlight memory from your time playing college basketball? Can you pick out one or two things that stick out about your college career?
I can pick out 10 bad things, and I'm sure, you know, that's the easy part. I don't know if I know. The same way.
No, I feel the same. I feel the same way. So I'm going to I'll just interject my little story before you tell yours. Okay. So if people ask me all the time, like I'll have somebody that'll say, hey, you know, what do you remember about that, you know, that OU game when you were a sophomore that you guys won? I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea. You know, we played them like 10 times over the course of my career. I don't know, you know, what the result of that game was if we won. But there's certainly the games that stick with me. I guess my point is the ones we lost. Those are the ones that I remember. And I think if you're, you know, I've asked a couple of different people this, and I don't ask everybody, but I already know your answer. And you ask the people, do you love to win more or do you hate to lose more? And I think that your ultra competitive people are the ones that hate to lose. I mean, everybody likes to win, but people who are truly competitive hate to lose. And I think that's coming through clear as day, you know, through the headphones here from you. And I felt exactly the same way when I was playing. So sorry to interrupt. Go ahead and tell your story.
I'll tell you two stories. Once, you know, the losses hurt way worse than the wins feel. And so it takes so much. We celebrate every win in the locker room with water guns and dumping water on some guy's head or being crazy in there, because when you lose, it hurts so bad, at least for a coaching staff and us, that we have to try to find a way to celebrate. Even if sometimes we beat a bad team by 1 point, and we got to fake it till we make it, we're still going to celebrate because you got to. But I'll tell you two stories. I'll tell you a bad one first. We're up by three. I just hit two free throws. I just hit a two to go up one. Then I got a defensive rebound, hit two free throws to go up three. We're at Illinois Wesleyan. It's about 20 minutes from where I grew up. I've got tons of friends and family. I'm a senior and 4 seconds left and we're calling a foul. And for whatever reason, myself and another guy, we didn't get the foul done. An All-American, their team, threw in one from the volleyball line. 3,000 people went nuts and they beat us by two in overtime. Ugh. And so that's the big one that cost us a conference championship. And so that's my biggest regret. First memory that comes to mind, that would have been a good one. However, the good memory was my freshman year, back to a tough year. We're up at Carthage. They're ranked number one in the country, and we're starting three freshmen, a senior, and a sophomore. And we go into their place, and we beat them when they're ranked number one in the country, and we're nothing. And they go 13-1 in conference, and they end up going to Final Four and having a good year, and we're the only team that beat them. And like I said, I think we're just too stupid to know what we were doing as a bunch of freshmen and sophomores to go in and beat them. And I can I remember I scored the first 5 points of the game, and they had a guy named Rob Garns who had NFL workouts, was an All-American. He wasn't guarding me. I scored 5 points. They put him on me. I didn't score the rest of the game, but we won, so I'll take it.
That's it.
We won, so yes.
It's funny, like, just hearing you talk about that, the first one, and hearing you talk about the loss, like, it's just those losses are just burned into you, and you'll be 95 years old, still thinking about that, wishing you could go back and play it over. And I know I have a couple losses on my ledger that I feel the same way, that they're sitting there, they still gnaw at me. There's probably not a week that goes by that I don't, at some point, it doesn't pop into my head because of whatever reason, something that reminds me of it, or I'm just thinking about, you know, whatever. And those things pop back in, and it's just incredible how much losing stings, especially when it was, you know, in an important situation.
That is a fact.
All right. So during your college career, obviously you have a tremendous amount of success. You're an All-American a couple years. When do you start to think that, hey, maybe I can play some professional basketball? And how does the opportunity come about that you get an opportunity to go over and play overseas in Europe? Talk about how that came to pass.
Yeah, so we talked about taking that year off, and I went to school, and so I could have graduated in 4 years and still have a year of eligibility left. So I was on pace to graduate in 4 years. I actually I walked after my 4 years and was planning on just going, being done. I had a job making a bunch of money, and business job was banking, and at the time I really enjoyed it. And once again, I took a step away from the game. I didn't do any postseason workouts. I didn't do any lifting. I didn't do anything. And, you know, midsummer comes around, and I'm like, okay, wait a second. Maybe I do want to do something. And I put some, you know, I changed my major, so I didn't have my degree yet. So we didn't do anything legal. But so I ended up going back the next year, not in the hopes to play in Europe, just because I one more opportunity. I mean, looking back, that's a no-brainer, right? I mean, at the time, it was tough. I was passing money to go pay some money, and I, you know, my family isn't incredibly affluent, and so anytime you're making a good salary, it's hard to pass that up. However, my boss was an awesome guy, and he allowed me to work part time and promised me the job after the season, and so that was great. So it was like a no-brainer to go back, and ended up going back and getting an opportunity. Had a good season, and it wasn't until the summer after my last year that I had some options, and I didn't look for it. I just had a couple of agents that reached out to the head coach, and you know, at the time there's not Twitter and all this stuff, and there's barely, you know, online videos. I don't know how they got anything, but being All American, they reached out and I had an offer, and I'll be honest with you, I just about didn't fax it in. My boss, who is a mentor and a close friend now, my boss at the bank, he's actually the one, he's like, give me that. He's like, if I would switch places with you right now, I would go there. Give me that. And he faxed it in without me knowing. And otherwise, who knows if I'd have done it. You know, my wife, my girlfriend, who like ended up being my wife, she had a job and I had a job, and we were just on the right path, you know, of whatever the next thing is. You know, I don't know. We were young and dumb, and we thought that was just kind of the next thing to do. And so, you know, you're all the uncertainty of going to Europe, you know, there's no guaranteed contracts over there. You get a 2-week tryout, and I'm thinking, oh, well, I'm some D3 player playing against guys. You know, there are guys from North Carolina in this league, and there are guys from, you know, St. John's in this league, and I'm going to go try to compete with those guys. There's no way I'm going to lose my, you know, $50,000 a year job, and, you know, I'm going to be away from my girlfriend who became my fiance and my wife. I'm going to be away from all that. What am I thinking here? And went over my first year and had a great experience, and got hurt in the championship game of the season, and hurt my ankle and missed half of the year the next year, and then went back 2 years later to Germany, and my wife went with me my last 2 years. And it was, you know, I think if I told my wife we got a call from Germany right now, I think she might have bags packed underneath our bed right now, because it was such a good experience for both of us.
So what was it like? Just talk to me about what it was like living in a foreign country. What was the best part of, aside from the basketball piece of it, what was the best part about getting a chance to live somewhere else and be there and just experience the culture?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, people always say, well, how'd you get around? I was in Luxembourg and Germany. You know, everybody, under a certain age, I think, you know, after, you know, a certain age, they had, you know, I think it was like if you're 48 or younger, you had like 8 years of English. So in Germany, in Luxembourg, everybody spoke fluent English. I mean, it was the games were in English. You know, people were commentating in English, announcing in English. You know, you go to the grocery store and, yeah, you got to, you know, get around a little bit and learn what, you know, the gherkin is a cucumber. But for the most part, everybody, you know, you go in a restaurant to order a pizza and they know what pepperoni and slam, you know, you know, they know what pepperoni and sausages and all that stuff. So there was not a language barrier where we were at ever. And so that was refreshing and nice. And we were in a really nice place. And, you know, I played for Bayer Leverkusen my last 2 years. So it was like Bayer Aspirin. So I knew I was going to get paid, which is a fear sometimes. You go out to Europe and you don't necessarily know where the money's coming from. I've had friends go to Turkey and, you know, they didn't get paid for 2 months at a time or 3 months at a time, and they didn't know if they were going to get checks. And so we were in really, really good situations every year we were there. And so that was refreshing. But the best part, I will tell you, was just the lifestyle. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, I think everything was slower, which I think it drives us Americans crazy. Sometimes you go to a restaurant and you have to sit for wait for water for 2 minutes. Well, you can go to Europe and you're going to wait 15 minutes before anybody comes up and says hi to you. And then they're not going to, you're going to ask for water, and then you're not going to see them for 15 more minutes. And, you know, now I think it would drive me nuts, but at the time, and I think once you accept it and you learn to love that and grow, the fact that you're going to go to dinner for 2.5-3 hours, it's an experience. And that's just what you're doing, as opposed to, I'm just going to dinner for 30 minutes to eat. But I'm going to dinner for 2.5-3 hours to enjoy the people I'm with. And I'm going to learn about the person I'm sitting across from. And I'm going to celebrate the night and do whatever. And so just the pace of life was awesome, you know. And I think my last year, my wife and I really learned to enjoy it. You know, my first year I was taking naps all the time and I was lifting every day and I never missed a practice the whole season. And I never, you know, games were a perfect regimen. I ate perfectly. I ate the same thing every day, 5 days a week until the weekends. And, you know, I was just on point with being the best basketball player I could be, which was important and valued. But then my last year, not to say that I wasn't as invested, but, you know, I'd say, coach, can I have Monday off? We don't play till Saturday. So we can go to Paris, or we can go to Prague, or we can go to, you know, someplace else. And so we go on trips all the time. And really, to our last year, really enjoyed our time there. And it didn't affect our play on the court. We had great success in my last year. And I was a decent player. And it was just a good experience. Once my mind shifted, once again, I didn't know what to expect. And once my expectations were changed and what I knew I was getting myself into, and you accept it and you hold on to it, and it was just great. We loved it.
Yeah, I think that you described it very, very, very well, the opportunity to go and just experience a different culture and just immerse yourself into it, opens your eyes. And I think that's something that, you know, we take for granted sometimes, is just what that opportunity affords us to be able to grow as a human being and to be able to experience other cultures. Just makes our lives richer. It makes us appreciate more the experiences and the opportunities that, you know, that we get. So before you jump into coaching, I told you in previewing the podcast to come up with your craziest European basketball story, because universally everybody has one. So go ahead and lay it on us. Give us your craziest European basketball story.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, this isn't my proudest moment, but we're in the semifinals in Luxembourg my first year, and it's game three, and it's only a 3-game series, and we're winning, and our team is my Luxembourgish players, so there's one American in each team, and my Luxembourgish players are much better than their Luxembourgish players, and apparently there's an altercation in the officials. I mean, there was no fist thrown, or there was no even pushing anybody, but the other American and myself and another player on their team just kind of, you know, you kind of jawing a little bit. And next thing you know, all three of us get tossed from the game. And I mean, we're in the second quarter. We're all tossed from the game. And I go back, they lock us in the locker room because they're scared we're going to fight. Nowadays, you see more of this, you know, I think this is just like the first quarter of the first game in the NBA season. It was so low key. And so I'm in the locker room and I have no idea what's going on in the game. There's no, you know, screens or anything like that, but they're live streaming online. So I'm in the locker room, my phone, calling my wife, who's watching the game online, to tell me what's going on. So I have no idea, you know, 30 feet away from me, what's going on, until she tells me we won the game to go to the finals. And the guys come in the locker room to celebrate and enjoy it. But it was just one of those things where I think the officials were like, okay, let's not get this out of hand. These guys are big and scary, and let's just lock them up in the locker rooms and see what happens with these Luxembourgish players. And luckily my team was a little bit better than their team that night. So yeah, that was one, like I said, not my proudest moment, but one memory that sticks out for sure.
That's funny. So during your playing career, are you thinking about, obviously you had a job lined up in banking before you got an opportunity to go and play in Europe for a few years. So I'm guessing that coaching wasn't necessarily always on your radar. So talk a little bit about how the opportunity to coach first there, your home team in Europe, and then eventually how that led you into coaching as a profession.
Yeah. So my first year in Luxembourg, I was, you know, part of my gig was to coach a 14-year-old team. And I'd never coached before. I'd done camps and done different things. And my college coach was always telling me, you know, because I wasn't super athletic. I wasn't a great shooter. I wasn't, you know, super – I couldn't dribble with my left hand to save my life. I still can't. But I was pretty good because I was a pretty smart player. He's like, you should be a coach. I'm like, no, there's no money in that. I want to be rich. And I want to make a bunch of money. I want to wear a suit every day. This is what I want. And then, you know, I get to Luxembourg and I have to coach these 14-year-olds. And I'll tell you, the first 2 weeks of coaching these 14-year-olds, they didn't speak any English. And it was like pulling teeth. It was just an awful experience. I'm trying to get them to run an offense. I'm trying to teach defensive principles. I'm trying to do different things, trying to put in a baseline and a bounds play, and they can't get me. But by the end of the, you know, 7-8 month season that we've got with these guys, there's a relation. They can't speak any English. I speak very little Luxembourgish. And yet somehow, some way, we've got an understanding and we've got a common goal and we have a relationship and we're bonding with these 14-year-olds over the game of basketball. And I loved it in the sense that we took a team that was really bad and like I said, a team that couldn't run an offense and, you know, didn't know what, you know, denying somebody on the wing was, and, you know, all they knew how to do was an on ball and that was about it, to, you know, helping develop these guys' skills, but also at the same time, you know, teach them how to be a good teammate, make sure they give high fives all the time. And we got it across. I mean, it might have taken, you know, an hour for me to teach these guys how important a high five was, and how saying good job to a teammate, even though he did something bad, was. And it might have taken a whole 2 weeks to get that done. But at the end of the day, the product was these kids all loved each other and they respected me and I had a relationship with them. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. And that experience really made me say, okay, maybe coaching is for me. Maybe I do enjoy the relationship. Because to me at the time, and even when I became a head coach in time, I thought basketball was just about X's and O's. You know, I had no idea that that's very, very little of what we do here in college coaching and probably in high school coaching too. It's more about the relationships and it's more about the leadership type things and life lessons. And I can, you know, we could go on and on about all the other things it's about. But in my mind, until that came about, I thought I was all X's and O's, and that made me kind of flip a switch and say, hey, there's more to this whole coaching thing. There's some influence and some mentorship and some different things that this could give us.
All right. So walk us through your stops prior to getting to Loras. Just talk a little bit briefly about each one of your stops and what you did, what you learned along the way, and then we'll start digging into your program at Loras.
Yeah, so that was my first gig, the 14-year-olds, and then, you know, I kind of, like I said, I had some injuries, went back and forth to Europe. My last year, I was actually a player coach in Pro B in Leverkusen, and I stopped playing after 7 or 8 games, had an injury, and it was done, so I just coached, and we took team with the lowest budget and made it the playoffs, and was a really successful year. We were just trying not to get relegated, to be honest with you. The Bayer Leverkusen was spent, they said 97%. They sponsored, obviously Bayer soccer plays in the Bundesliga and I think Champions League a couple of years ago and soccer. And so they said 97% of the money's going to soccer now. And so with that being said, they got 3% for the other like 40 sports. And so we were just trying to stay in Pro B where they could, you know, wrestle up some more sponsors. And we had did a great job with what we had and had some good players and had some good success and won the last five games to get in the playoffs and stay up. And then after that, I went to Elmhurst where I was at as the full-time assistant. And luckily it was the coach that I played for, a coach that I quit on. And like I said, had a great relationship with him. And then he actually semi-retired. And then Coach Baines, who I know that you know, he came on as the head coach and I stayed as the assistant. And we had a relationship. He was my assistant. He coached me as well. And so he kept me on and we had a good couple years. So my first 2 years as the head assistant at Elmhurst, we won 11 games, I think 11 or 12 games combined that first 2 years. My last 2 years as the assistant in my first recruiting class, we won 43 games. We ranked second in the country. And of that, very first recruiting class, we had 9 guys stick it out. And then the last game that I coached as the assistant, all 9 guys played, and those are the only 9 guys that played. And so it was a pretty special year and a special group that went through there at Elmhurst. And then luckily we had great guys that did an awesome job, and then it afforded me the opportunity to get this job here at Loras. And so Loras has been unbelievable. It's a great place. We absolutely love it here in Dubuque, and it's a place definitely we call home. Loras was always a place that we recruited against, and it was always a place that, you know, always had really good players, but for whatever reason, I hadn't put it together. And I was like, this place is great. Facilities are, you know, top 10 in Division III. They're unbelievable. I mean, the campus is awesome. The name recognition and everybody knows Loras, and why is this place not winning? This place is great. And so I get on campus and more so than that, the people are just awesome. And it's been a really good spot. In our first year, we won the league, and second year we got second in the league to the national champs, Nebraska Wesleyan. And last year we took a step forward and went to the Sweet 16 before we lost the national champions, Oshkosh, at their place. And now we're working on year 4. So we've had 3 really good years. I've been blessed to have some really good players and awesome assistants that know much more than I do, and been really, really happy with everything Loras has for us.
So when you walked in the door that first day and you obviously knew that the program had potential, what were one or two things that you looked at and you said, okay, if we're going to get where I want to go, if we're going to take this program to what I believe its potential is, these are the things that need to change, or these are the things that I need to do, I need to instill in the program. Can you talk about what maybe those things were, what your general thought process was for how you were going to build the type of culture and program that you wanted to have there?
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I mean, we talked about it a little bit, but when I got the job, I called some guys that I knew, that obviously a bunch of mentors and a bunch of people. And I also had some common connections with a guy named Mike Rhodes, who Coach Rhodes is now the head coach of VCU. He was at Rice. He's been a couple different stops, and he started at the D3 level. And my best friend worked with him down at Rice for a year or two. And I talked to him, and he gave me the best advice I'd ever gotten that I needed at the time. And he said, because, you know, I'm trying, you know, first time head coach, and I'm, you know, you're thinking about your offense, your defense, and you're, you know, I want to do this, I want to do this. You have these grandiose plans. And he says, he's like, the best advice I can give you is you got to be yourself. More than anything, you have to be yourself. You can fake it. You can fake being like what Coach K does you see on Twitter. You can fake being what Shaka Smart does, or you can fake being what Coach Calipari does, or anybody else. You go down on Popovich. You can try to emulate those guys as much as you want and learn from those guys and grow and read about them and do different things. And I've done all that stuff. However, the most important thing you can do is you can be yourself, because you can't fake that. And when times are tough, you're going to have to be yourself, and it's going to come out. And so you don't want to be two-faced. You don't want your guys to not trust in you and believe in you. You have to be who you are. And that was the best advice I had. And so, you know, from day one, you know, I was at my alma mater. My wife was teaching at a Christian high school in Chicagoland. For me to come out here to Loras, we were not going to go to a place that was not one, treat their coaches great in a great family environment, a great town and a great area and close to where we grew up, but also a place that we knew could win. That was important. You know, we're going to go to a place that we can win because, you know, as well as I do, you go to a place that's set up for losing. It might be your last stop. And, you know, you might not be there in 4 or 5 years. And Loras is a place that's set up where, you know, if we're not winning, they've done a great job. That's all me. And I can sleep at night knowing if we don't win, it's something myself or my staff has done. It's not because of Loras. It would be, I'll own that. And so that's a big part. So the first day that came in, we were who we were. You know, my staff and I were, you know, hired a guy that's uber competitive, just like me. And we fed off each other and a couple other coaches that were just the right yin to our yang. And so we just started to instill the culture of competing every single day in everything you do, whether it's classroom or on the court or off the court or in the weight room or wherever it was. We just wanted a different level of toughness and in the right amount of edge. And I'll tell you the biggest thing, which I think our group and I think other teams in our league and other teams that play us will say we have edge. Finding the right amount of edge. Sometimes you don't want to have too much, you know, you definitely don't want to have too little. And I think our group is just trying to find its groove and the right amount of edge. And that's really been the focus from day one. And I think that'll continue to be our focus, is to have a good edge and to have a high level of competitiveness and togetherness. And we obviously do things like a lot of programs do and have our staples and our pillars. But I would say above all else, we are who we are. We're in the fight with our team. And I don't think that there's anybody in our group that's played for us or is playing for us that would ever doubt our love and our fight for them. And I think that's just who I've always been. And that's where our program's at.
So obviously now, as you've been there for several years, you're able to bring in, and we talked about your recruiting process and some of the things that you look for and being able to bring in those guys that are competitive. But that first year, you inherit a group of guys that are coming back that weren't recruited by you. So how do you go about, what do you remember about that transition for those players and how you got them to buy into the new program and what that process was like for you? Because obviously you have a vision, but you also have a set of players that you've inherited. So how do you take those players who weren't recruited by you and mold them into the type of team that you've been able to create, the type of program you'd be able to create in your first couple of years?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's kind of a really deep question in the sense that most, I would say half the guys that I inherited were guys I actually did recruit, you know, that I lost.
Right. Yeah, true. Lures, yeah,
you know?
True.
You know, I think one guy is a player, Danny, and Danny actually was a senior leader for us that year that I got there. I recruited the heck out of him when I was at Elmhurst. Didn't get him, but he was the best leader I've ever coached, and he accepted me right away because, you know, we had a relationship, and I knew what he was about, and I recruited the heck out of him because I knew he was a competitive guy that came out here, and we lost him, and he actually now is my assistant, so he's working for me, and he's awesome. But you know, some of those guys we knew what we were getting ourselves into, but we were lucky we got hired in April and brought in 3 or 4 guys. And I'll tell you, of the 3 or 4 guys that we brought in to that group, 2 of those guys were competitive guys. You know, one obviously ended up being an All-American, was awesome, but he was just the culture he helped create. So it was a good mix of bringing in some of our own guys in that first year, but also the returners, the guys we inherited, were awesome guys that wanted to be pushed. That's the thing. I we talked about it before. Even if they don't have that competitive edge and have never had, you never really have been asked to be pushed, I think as long as you got good guys, and we did, as long as you got good guys, they're willing to be pushed, and that's what they needed. I think that this group has been that first group that we had, they were like, wanted it. They were striving for it. They were, you know, looking for that edge and to be pushed. It wasn't like they were a group that was fighting back. So I give those guys credit. You know, they could have put their backs against the wall and be like, hey, I didn't choose to play for this guy. But they, you know, through getting to know me and my staff, I think that they were just like, okay, these guys are going to push the heck out of us, and they expect a lot of us, but they're going to love us, and they're going to be in the fight with us, and they're going to compete with us, and they are going to be in it with us. And so They were really accepting, and you know, Danny was one of those guys. Like I said, now he works for me. You know, is kind of the everybody's looking to him, saying, "Okay, what's he going to do here?" And it only takes, you know, one or two of those guys that are leaders. Everybody's looking at them, be like, "Okay, are they going to accept this? Are they going to be all in with this?" And you know, the minute that they were in, and they like said they co-signed on us as a staff, I think everybody else just fell into place. And so, like I said, we had a bunch of good guys that were willing to accept us coaches, and I give them more credit than us.
Yeah, it's amazing how being a good teammate or being a bad teammate can be contagious. Mm-hmm. And so if you get the right guys in place and you get the right guys on board, that they can have a tremendous influence on the rest of the group. And it sounds like that's what was able to happen for you right out of the gate. And then I guess my second part of that, the question that I have is, how do you go about building those relationships that allow you to push your guys to make sure that everything is, that they're competing as hard as they can? How do you build the kinds of relationships that are required when you're going to push your guys and coach them hard? How do you build those relationships day to day? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, the biggest thing, and we tell them this all the time, is we're not going to ask them to do something we're not willing to do. You know, so when we're in practice and we do a rebounding drill, or say we're doing 5-on-5 and I'm coaching against Coach Miller and Danny's reffing and my team loses and you got a down and back, I run the down and back. And when we after practice, if they're tired and they got a lift and we go and do a lift, I'm going to lift with them even though I'm tired and old too. And I'm going to do a box jump with them, you know, even though they're doing a box jump. Mine definitely won't be as high. However, I'm going to sweat with my guys and I'm going to do the exact same thing. I'm not a morning person. My kids wake me up. That's the best part about my job. And so we don't do morning workouts. I'm not a fan of, you know, coaches having guys, you know, do 5, 6 a.m. workouts and there's maybe one coach there or the strength condition coach is there and they're not there. Well, if you're not willing to be there, you know, they're going to look at it like, what the heck are we doing here? And so we don't ever ask our guys to do, we do fundraising stuff. And, you know, if a guy has to, we're doing, you know, an after school program. And if they got to work too, I got to work too. And so for us, we talk about it all the time that we're very, you know, it's not a dictatorship. It's not a hierarchy. You know, this is a democracy and our program is incredibly linear. We want our guys to call their own plays. We want our guys to make decisions and own their team. And I think that's just something we talk about all the time. I mean, you know, I'll give you an example. Last year we were winning games and we got a really senior laden team and we got some older guys and we do rebounding drills every day. It's important to our program as it is with a lot of programs, or it should be. And so we do rebounding drills. They come in, it's like, all right, coach, we're sick of beating up on each other in rebounding drills. We're going 2-on-2 versus coaches on these pads. We're going 3-on-3 against each other. Like, what is the deal? It's January. We've out-rebounded every team but three so far. Like, why are we doing this? I was like, well, first of all, that's why we've out-rebounded every team but three is because we're doing this. But more importantly, I'm like, I'm fine with not doing rebounding drills. We're still going to rebound. So you tell me how we can take this team and we can get everybody to still to rebound and not do rebounding drills. Whatever that is, I'm all in. At the end of the day, we're only doing this stuff so we can get on the glass. So you tell me what to do. And we've got a chart percentage. We've got some analytics interns that are with our program. And we've got a certain percentage on the offensive side, what we want to go to the glass, what percent our team is going to go. Obviously, it's a certain range. And we said, okay, well, if we're at that number every game, we don't have to do any rebounding drills. How about that? And if we give up less than X amount of rebounds on the defensive side, so guys, we only give up 9 offensive rebounds or 11 offensive rebounds, or their offensive rebound percentage was whatever we had decided on. I said, we're good. I said, if they ever change, if they ever go down, we're doing rebounding drills. And I'll tell you, there's only two games that we didn't keep that where we needed it to be. And we did rebounding drills for those, you know, two practices before the next game. But other than that, we didn't do rebounding drills down the stretch. And, you know, that was just a bunch of leaders coming in, you know, owning their team saying, hey, let's do this. I'm like, yeah, I'm on board. Whatever, it's your team. You know, we're just here to hold you accountable and to help you and serve you. And so our, you know, we'll see when I'm old and washed up if I'm still doing box jumps with the guys after practice, or if, you know, if I'm still as easygoing about doing rebounding drills. But for us, we just want to get in the fight with our guys and let them know that they can take as much ownership in their team as they want. And the more that they take, the better we're going to be. You know, on the back of our warmups, it said own it, because it's their team. And I think the guys have done a really good job of doing that.
All right, two things. One, where did you come up with the idea, the thought of getting in and doing things, the physical activities with your guys? Was that something that you saw somebody else do? Was that something that just seemed to naturally make sense to you, coming at it from maybe a former player perspective? How did you come up with that thought, first of all? Let's answer that, and then I'll come back to the second thing.
Yeah, as an assistant, I was always in there doing stuff, and now I'm getting old and washed up. And so, like, I always wanted to do stuff and get in there, and you know, somebody's messing something up on the scout team. I was always anxious to get in there and get in the fight, and I was always wondering if the head coach was okay with that, but I felt like it was going to help. And so I'm like, I need to get in there and do that thing. I like to be in shape, and our staff loves to be in shape. And so it's kind of just something we stumbled on. And I feel like our guys now, they're, you know, they'll hold us accountable. Coach, why don't you run this line? Like, dang it. You're right. All right. Or if I'm, you know, they'll say it to us, you know? And so, like, you know, sometimes I'm like, hey, my knee is bad news bears. I'll do how many push-ups for every line? And they'll say like a million. I'm like, no, how about that? And so, you know, we'll do something along the lines. And we, you know, guys, once again, it goes back to that, you know, our team is linear. It's better when they hold us accountable. I know we're in a good spot as a team when they're holding me accountable and they're holding our staff accountable and my assistants are holding me accountable and we're all in that thing together. And so I will tell you, it's just kind of something we stumbled on, and I think our guys have loved it. Like I said, we'll see when both my knees are broken and I have no hair, if I'm still living that life. But as of right now, I'm still good to go.
Yeah. Let me tell you, I coach middle school cross country, and every time we do a workout and I'm not doing it, I get yelled at and criticized. Yeah. And guilted into doing it. Like, we do bleachers. We do bleachers every Monday. This past Monday, I was like, I wasn't feeling it, but the kids guilted me into it. And let me tell you, Monday night, I was a sore puppy. That's all I know.
Preach it. But hey, you know what? Your kids respect you more now that you did it, even especially when you didn't feel like it. And, you know, for me, it's been good doing those things. I get, you know, you kind of get a feel for where your team's at mentally and physically, too. It's been really an advantage to us, you know, when you see guys doing stuff and you're asking them to lift after practice, you know, 3 days, you know, 3 out of 5 days. And now you go from practice into lifting and you're on a Friday and then you got a scrimmage the next day or something. And you're thinking, my body's like, man, I'm struggling. And I've been eating right. And I don't even go to class, for crying out loud. And, and so, like, you know, I can just kind of, it helps frame a little bit where these guys are coming from.
Yeah. I can see from a player standpoint, and I never experienced that as a player, a coach that jumping in and doing any of those things. And when I was a younger coach, I actually always kind of went the other way, in that I always felt like I didn't want to jump in and feel like I was, I don't know, showing up my players was the right way to look at it. And so I think it's really, again, I could see from a player standpoint where you jumping in would really benefit your team, and that, hey, we're not going to ask you to do anything that we're not willing to do. And maybe we can't do it at the same speed or the same height or the same level, but certainly you're showing them that, hey, we're right here. And that's got to be able to build trust and camaraderie and teamwork and all that thing, all the things that we all preach and that we all want to make it a part of our programs. I think that there's no question that for you, that works. And I think that it's something that I'm always interested in learning about, how different people do different things. And that's something that, you know, I haven't heard anybody, especially on the college level. Occasionally you get somebody in a high school, you know, at the high school level, maybe a younger coach that jumps in and does some stuff. But from a college perspective, I think that's probably fairly unique. Do you know anybody else in the other programs where people are doing that? Yeah.
And no, I don't. And I'll tell you, not one thing that I got, you know, when we got hired here, I was asking coaches, and they're like, well, you need to make sure you're a youngish coach. I think I got hired when I was, you know, 33 or something. So I don't know if that's young or old. I think I'm always going to say I'm a youngish coach, because in my mind I am.
Absolutely.
However, my wrinkles and my bald spot would tell you differently. And so I felt like people had said, you know, hey, make sure that you're not the assistant anymore. You can't be buddy buddy with them. You know, you're not the assistant. You don't want to be too close. You got to be, you know, you're the guy that's making decisions on who's playing. And I kind of thought about that. I'm like, why did, who said that? Who's why? Nobody said that. Like, why not be closer with them? And why not be, you know, in the fight with them? You know, I had great relationships as an assistant coach that I felt like selfishly helped us win games. And, you know, I know there's awesome head coaches and there's awesome, you know, players in our program, but I felt like some of those relationships, I'm like, why can't we emulate that as a head coach? And why can't I do that stuff? And so, you know, as a young coach, I don't, my advice to youngish head coaches or, you know, you take over a program when you're 30 or 28 or 33 or whatever it is, isn't to separate yourself from the guys. One, unless that's who you are, right? I mean, if that's who you are and you want to be in your office and be super serious and kind of say, hey, this is how we do things, do it. But I don't think that there's any rule that says, hey, you need to set some boundaries here because you're young and they need to know that there's a difference and you're not their buddy. Well, I'm not trying to be their buddy, but I'm also not trying to, you know, be their parent either. And so, you know, trying to find that balance and letting guys, I just have never bought into the fact that as a younger coach, you need to separate yourself. I just haven't found that to be successful for us.
Well, that goes back to the very beginning of the conversation and the best piece of advice that you said you ever got, which was you got to be yourself.
Right.
And I think that that's something that a lot of young coaches sometimes get caught up in is, hey, I want to be like this famous coach. And so I'm going to try to emulate and do everything that they do. And sure, like you said, you can learn from those people and you can take bits and pieces from all those great coaches, or you can listen to a podcast, or you can read a book, or you can go to a coaching clinic, or, you know, watch some online video, and you can certainly take and borrow things from everybody, and you should. That's what you should be doing. But ultimately, you have to incorporate that into your coaching style and your personality. And that's when you really, I think, find true success. Because we all know you could listen to 100 different coaches talk, and although there might be some common themes, each coach attacks it in slightly a different way. And so there's all different ways of being able to be successful. And I think you said it best when you talked about just being true to yourself. And when you're true to yourself, that enables you to have the most success. And for you, this has worked. Now, for somebody else, maybe it wouldn't. But I think it's something that, for sure, as I look at it and trying to analyze it from the outside, I could see the tremendous benefit of how it helps to connect the coaching staff to players, which ultimately tightens those bonds, which ultimately allows you to push one another to higher and higher levels of success. I can see the benefit. There's just, I can see it clearly.
Agreed.
Let's talk a little bit about, we're getting close to an hour and a half. I want to ask you another question or two, and then we'll start to wrap up. So next question I want to talk to you about is just talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you face within your season. What do you feel are the biggest challenges that you face, maybe just generally as a Division III college head coach, and then maybe specifically to Loras? What are some of the challenges day in, day out that you face as the head, the face of a program?
Man, are we talking in season basketball wise, or are we just talking in general? Or are you?
I'm talking in general. Let's go in general, because I think probably I can, you know, I mean, basketball wise, we could probably delve into a million things, but I think just in general, just for people to get an understanding of maybe some of the things that you face challenge wise that are maybe not basketball specific.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I guess not a challenge that maybe I didn't expect is getting into coaching is how much it's not about the X's and O's. You know, the challenge of getting guys all, you know, on the same page, valuing the same things, especially, you know, at our level, Division III level, you get to see them, you know, one meeting together, and then you're not seeing them together until the season starts, you know. And so not being able to be around your guys a ton in the off season, in the preseason, and then again in the postseason, but yet still trying to find ways to get your guys together and get your guys on the same page and get your seniors with your freshmen, and understanding that the seniors need those freshmen. You know, there's going to be some of them that are going to play and they need them to be on the same page. There needs to be some type of relationship and just all the things that are around that have nothing to do with, you know, what defense you're running and what offense you're running, but yet are incredibly, incredibly valuable and important. Those are just things that, you know, I'm learning in year four here to put more emphasis and more timing on. You know, we've been sitting here scheduling our practice schedules around different sports and the gym. And, you know, we're putting, okay, well, when are we going to talk as a team? And when are we going to do this? My first year, I think we're just, you know, talking about what offenses are we running, what defense are we running. But now, you know, at the exact same time in year four, we're talking, okay, when are we going to talk about family? And when are we going to talk about attitude? And when are we going to talk about, you know, what it takes to be a good teammate? And what are we going to talk about, what kind of edge we want and different things? And so when are we going to get this player to hang out with this player? Because we know socially they're just totally different, yet they're both big parts of our program. And so the biggest thing is just trying to manage all of those things that are incredibly valuable. And I'll tell you, I've learned so much at Loras about culture, you know, from our women's basketball coach is just, he averages winning about 20 wins a year. He is unbelievable. When you talk about culture, he sums it up. I mean, it's got a picture of him in the dictionary. He still doesn't know what offense or defense is. He won't put in an offensive thing for about a week before this first game, for crying out loud.
That's awesome.
However, it doesn't matter because his culture is so unbelievably strong in his women's program that it really doesn't matter. And so, like, just seeing that and then seeing our men's soccer coach is just unbelievably culture driven. And our track and cross country coaches are unbelievably culture driven, and all program, and same thing with our wrestling program. We got second in the country. Seeing all these high level programs, yeah, you got to recruit your tail off, and yes, you got to know what you're doing, and you got to be able to motivate your players, and you got to have relationships, and that stuff's all important. But finding out what culture you want and how to create it and how to get everyone on the same page, I've learned so much at Loras from amazing programs and coaches that I've, like I said, I never heard the word culture as an assistant coach. And it's nothing against the head coaches I coached for or coached with, or the head coaches I played for. They were awesome coaches and good friends, and we did things a different way. But seeing how important it is here and with those programs has really made me shift from what I valued then 3-4 years ago to what I value now. I think it's changed. And just trying to plan all that stuff and get it all organized and get it all in, I think that's a challenge that I guess I never really accounted for.
Yeah, I can see that, where that becomes a whole bunch of stuff on your plate that, as a young guy, and again, somebody who's getting into coaching, you don't necessarily always think about those off the court things. And, you know, now there's so many opportunities for you to learn from, as you just described, great people. But then there's just so many books and resources and things that you can go to be able to, again, borrow, steal things that you can then incorporate into what you want to do. All right, final question. What's your biggest joy day to day of being the head coach at Loras?
I think it's, you know, the coaches I coach with and the guys I see all the time it's a close community at Loras. And that's, I think, for some people in some places, that's not a good thing. I think some places and some people just want to go to work, and you kind of go, you know, get in your bubble and do your work, and you be successful and super happy doing that. For me, there's not really a bubble here at Loras. You know, the best part is, you know, I'm my assistants are close. I'm close friends with them. Our women's basketball coach, our cross country coach, like I mentioned, I'm in a small group with my wife and our families with four other, you know, employees, three coaches and five other employees here and their spouses. And that's awesome. I love going to work every day with people that value the same things as I value. And that's really important. And then, you know, when we didn't talk about recruiting too much, but once the season starts and I'm around my guys, people ask us what we look for in players. And I look for good guys that work hard. And the biggest reason is my kids, you know, we go to the national tournament, my kids get to ride the bus on the way there, and they're not sitting by me. You know, they're sitting by, you know, a couple of my players because they want, they look up to them so much. And I want to make sure that the guys that are around my family and the guys I'm going to be around, the guys my assistants are going to be around, the guys going to be around each other are just good dudes that work hard. I mean, we had a recruit in 2 weekends ago that I'm not sure that didn't fit that bill. And we crossed his name off the recruiting sheet. He was a great player, and He's, you know, comes from a really good AU program and a high school that's awesome, but he's just not a fit for us. And so, like, I can't imagine my kids sitting by him and what he's going to talk about, what he's going to do on the bus to the national tournament. And so for us, just making sure that we've got, you know, a good vetting system for good guys that work hard in our program makes my day-to-day and my life so much better being around good dudes, win or lose. If you're a good guy and you're a good person, and hopefully I think our staff is, I think that goes a long way.
Love it. All right, Chris, if you wouldn't mind, share your contact information for how people can reach out to you if they've listened to the podcast and want to ask you a question or just want to connect with you. And then if there's anything else that we didn't hit on tonight in our hour and a half, go ahead and share your final parting shot, and then we'll come back and I'll wrap up the episode.
No, man. First of all, I appreciate you guys having me on. It's quite the honor. I saw some of the other names and coaches that I've known, and some of the names I haven't known, to be just in that conversation, maybe as even an afterthought, is awesome. So I really appreciate you guys. My contact information, my email is christopher.martin @loras.edu. And then on Twitter, I'm cmart2323. Don't make fun of that. That is from a long time ago. And so you can hit me up on either of those two things. I'd love to answer any questions or talk offense or talk culture or talk defense or just hear about anybody else's programs. Because like you mentioned, us coaches, we're not reinventing the wheel all the time. We're just stealing and borrowing from other people. I know there's a lot of great coaches out there that I would love to hear from and steal from. But other than that, I don't have too much, man. I'm really happy with where we're at as a program, and we love Loras, and I don't have a whole lot. I just appreciate you guys letting me come on and tell my story. It's the first time I've had the opportunity to kind of tell my story as from a kid to where I got to. So it was nice to be able to hear myself kind of talk about how I got here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a lot of fun. We can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us. And again, we talked about it earlier, but coaches are just so willing to share and just open up. And one of the things that we feel like we've been able to do is to be able to dive in deeper with guys like yourself who maybe don't always have the opportunity to get their stories told. And I think there's a ton of value in what you shared tonight. I think anybody who listens can pick out a bunch of nuggets that they can take back with them to their program as a coach and hopefully learn something that can help them to improve their program. And so we can't thank you enough for being on with us, Chris. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.